491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFDRadio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 305, recorded on Sunday, April 26th, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line, as always, from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
Well, Rachel, we're going to be talking this week about the early United States oil industry. And why is it that we're going to be talking about the early U.S. oil industry this particular week?
Well, on Monday, we saw the market for oil just basically bottom out. Well, more than bottom out.
More than bottom out.
By the end of Monday, I think it was minus $37. So you would have to pay people to take your oil off your hands, basically. So, yeah, it was pretty dire. It happened really, really fast. I think over an hour, I saw it go from like $4 a barrel to that negative number. So just happened really, really fast and really suddenly. And it kind of spurred on a whole bunch of, oh no, what are we going to do now? Finance pieces from like Bloomberg or Yahoo Finance. So it was a pretty big deal, even though it feels like an eternity ago already. Even if it was only 6 days ago, it feels like a long time ago.
As usual, we will have links to all of this stuff up at arsenalfordemocracy.com when this episode comes out. But as Rachel said, there was a flash crash sort of thing where not only did the oil prices that were already quite low per barrel reach zero, but they then continued down below zero, which, you know, is with certain types of things and markets, you wouldn't have that happen. And this had, you know, not really happened before either. This is, you know, a relatively unprecedented thing. This was not only the lowest since the oil crises of the 1970s, but it is apparently the first time ever below zero. As Rachel alluded to, a lot of that sort of concept of below zero refers to the notion of essentially either paying people to buy it from you, or more correctly, that you would be paying people to store the oil until the price went back up and you could sell it later, which is something that we are going to be talking about in the context of the early U.S. oil industry. Now, neither Rachel nor I are experts in the oil industry or the oil markets or anything like that, but we are more historically focused on the show. And that's why we're going to be talking about the early U.S. oil industry so that people can kind of better understand that. Obviously, there's a lot of factors that are in play in the current situation in terms of there was a production war happening between Saudi Arabia and Russia that led to too much oil being on the market in terms of, controlling the price, which that was a major theme of the, as we'll talk about, of the early U.S. oil industry, was too many, you know, too much production happening, very volatile swings in the markets and everything. And then eventually, sort of after the period, we're going to be talking about eventually forming not exactly cartels per se, but basically agreements to maintain certain levels of production caps and things like that so that there wouldn't be too much oil coming out on the market. Obviously, coronavirus is a huge factor as well in this situation, in that there's been a significant decrease in the demand for oil pretty rapidly around most of the world. And that has been a factor in the, you know, pricing as well. And there's various other things that are all sort of compounding up here. But that's the situation that we are in. Let's go back to the very beginning, though, and talk about the Pennsylvania oil rush. Obviously, before 1859, when the Pennsylvania oil rush started, there had been thousands of years around the world of people, you know, there were areas like Iran, say, in the Persian Empire, where you'd just have kind of oil bubbling out of the ground, and you could use it for various things. Like there's supposedly cases that maybe there was asphalt being used, or primitive forms of asphalt being used, or, you know, with the tar and everything. You'd have some people using lamps. In the United States, you had both patent medicine and indigenous medicines attempting to use oil or oil byproducts coming out of the ground for various things. But in 1859, in Titusville, Pennsylvania, we see Drake's Well, which is not it's not the first oil well, but it's basically the kickoff to the oil rush in Pennsylvania. Titusville is in the far northwestern corner of Pennsylvania, around 45 to 50 miles southeast of Erie, Pennsylvania, which is in turn 103 miles along Lake Erie from Cleveland, Ohio. You have to go west. It is east of Cleveland, but if you go west, you get to Cleveland. Alternatively, you could also connect from Oil Creek, where this oil rush started, using the creek to get to the Allegheny River, and then go 132 miles south on the river to Pittsburgh. But essentially, there was a free-for-all from 1859 into the early 1870s, where there were all these people coming in and drilling oil wells and having too much production and all this stuff, and it was very volatile, as we're going to talk about. Then the industry sort of got more organized and started controlling the production more. And a lot of the stuff that happens in this Pennsylvania oil rush sets the terms and the way of doing things that we still see even to present day, really, in terms of how oil markets work, you know, and how you trade oil and things like that. By the 1890s, production had peaked completely in Pennsylvania, and other regions of the U.S. like California and Texas became the major focus of oil drilling. Other things that were sort of pioneered in this oil boom and oil rush in Pennsylvania, and we're calling it an oil rush partly, I mean, that's also what it's referred to, but it's also because it's similar to some of the gold rushes that had happened previously, like in the 1840s and so forth. But storage and transportation were other key developments in this region that, you know, have similar ramifications to today. One of the things that we were seeing in news articles just a few weeks ago, before this flash crash put the price of oil into the negative, was a similar issue of scrambling to find places to store oil so in such great quantities that the oil companies were trying to persuade the railroads that they should just be allowed to store oil indefinitely in oil tank cars on various, you know, sidings on the railroads. And the railroads were understandably not happy about that. The tank car trains are not meant for that. And that's, you know, that's not necessarily the safest practice to just be leaving those around. So they weren't happy about that. But again, that speaks to this issue of, well, you know, the price will come back up, so we're not going to cut the production now, but we can just store some of this oil temporarily. As some of these articles that Rachel mentioned from Bloomberg and Yahoo mentioned, it has gotten to the point now where most of the producers are shutting down production in the United States, or at least, you know, some percentage of their production, realizing that if they continue to you know, pump more and more and more, they're backing themselves deeper and deeper into a hole where there's not enough capacity, and therefore they don't have any place to put the oil, and they have to start just paying people to take it away so that it's not sitting around. This is something that we found as Rachel and I were reading through the materials on the early U.S. oil industry. We saw a lot of parallels to this. So this was a recommendation by my friend Jillian. Is Ida Tarbell's book from the turn of the last century. Ida Tarbell was an investigative reporter who famously wrote a book on the history of Standard Oil. And it's available online from the Internet Archive. It's about 400 pages long and very readable. I've already read a quarter of it. Rachel's a little bit further behind, but we were both commenting that we were surprised how engaging the writing was. But let's get into her history in chapter one of the emergence of the oil field industry and the transportation sector in Pennsylvania. So as I said, there was a prior history of oil pre-existing before this. You had the medicines, the lamps, lamp oil, gas, paraffin wax, lubricating oil. You had all these experiments and publications in the mid-1850s to 1859. There were saltwater drilling sites in the region that were already, you know, producing oil as kind of a byproduct, but they weren't using it for anything, or they were only using it for these limited purposes. And Colonel Drake comes along, sent out by a company to do some experiments, and he used a steam engine ultimately to sink a well 69 and a half feet specifically for pumping crude oil. It took him nearly a year to figure out how and where to drill and to procure the needed equipment and crew. But once he was successful, immediately other people rushed to the area, began coming in, buying land in huge amounts and started drilling. Sometimes they would just use, you know, hand drills, rudimentary drills, things like that. Eventually, though, you could get a well with good equipment. You could get like 1,600 feet down and so forth. From 1859 to 1869, there were over 5,500 wells drilled, although nearly 4,400 of them were false attempts that either failed to find oil or didn't find enough to be profitable. And that sort of leads us to our understanding of sort of the volatility. So, Rachel, could you talk about that boom and bust cycle that happened with this sort of not Wild West, but something akin to that?
Yeah. So like you said, once oil was discovered in that area, people, speculators, gamblers, just kind of people with a little bit of money in their pockets, and I guess the moxie to try to make some more money out of that, flooded into the area. And like you said, just started buying land. The land wasn't very desirable, initially, because it was just like this remote logging area pretty much. So
you couldn't farm there because it would either be rocky or sandy, or there would literally be oil bubbling up if you tried to plow, and that's not great for your crops.
And it was extremely hard to get to because it was so remote, and there just wasn't a lot of railroad development at that time. Like I said, people were just flooding the area, just digging wells to see what they could get. And as these new wells were discovered, and as more and more wells were being drilled, the supply would just kind of overwhelm the market. And then, as is happening now, the prices bottom out. So one example, in January of 1860, oil was $20 a barrel. And by the end of 1861, it was 10 cents a barrel. So it was just very, very volatile. I think there wasn't a lot of communication on like how to keep the market stable, because it was kind of these roughneck people just kind of coming in with a hope and a prayer. So it swung very volatilely. So until these kind of like market people with a little bit more knowledge about how markets worked and how speculation worked came in, it was very wild. On page 32 of the book, there was a farmer, McCray, who just kept storing his oil because he didn't like the price, and he famously said to everybody he wouldn't sell for under $5. And it actually reached $5, and he still was kind of waiting for it to go up a little bit more. But then the market started dropping. The price kept dropping. And then eventually it dropped to $1.20 per barrel, and he was forced to sell at a huge loss. So you had to be pretty savvy. And a lot of these people that were just former farmers or former gold miners didn't always have the know-how to turn a profit.
And this was a relatively rapid emergence too, as we'll talk about. I mean, this was a huge influx in capital investment into this region, which, as you said, was totally remote and underdeveloped at the time when this started in 1859. By 1872, oil coming out of this one corner of northwestern Pennsylvania totaled 40 million barrels. That wasn't per year. That was over the whole period of a little bit over a decade. And at that point, it was the fourth largest foreign export of the United States. In 1871, there was 152 million gallons exported that year alone. Again, that's gallons, not barrels, just for clarity. And they had developed a demand market across the entire world. The book talks about various countries where they had gone from zero demand for oil to almost overnight being like, oh yeah, I'd like to buy some oil. And we're not going to talk this week about Standard Oil or the refinery wars or things like that. We're mostly just talking about the crude oil production and transportation in Pennsylvania. We're probably going to come back either next week or very soon to talk more about the next phase of the oil industry. We're just initially talking about the oil industry origins. The capital investment, sort of the know-how and big money, was very important to the development of this, as Rachel just alluded to. Quote, from the East came men with money and business experience who formed great stock companies, took up lands in parcels of thousands of acres, and put down wells along every rocky run and creek, as well as over the steep hills. The methods Drake had used were crude and must be improved. The processes of refining were those of the laboratory and must be developed. Communication with the outside must be secured. Markets must be built up. Rachel, if you go to page 28, there was an interesting sort of anecdote getting to that communication point you were just talking about, where it was, even if they understood that producing too much oil or whatever could cause price problems, they had kind of a hard time figuring out what to do. And they talk about this, the plight of, let's say, a hypothetical man with a 1,000-barrel well in 1862. And they talk about this issue of selling and storage and that sort of thing, and the brokers and buyers and everything.
A man with a 1,000-barrel well on his hands in 1862 was in a plight. He had got to sell his oil at once for lack of storage room or let it run on the ground, and there was no exchange, no market, no telegraph, not even a post office within his reach where he could arrange a sale. He had to depend on buyers who came to him. These buyers were the agents of the refineries in different cities or of the exporters of crude in New York. They went from well to well on horseback if the roads were not too bad, on foot if they were, and at each place made a special bargain varying with the quantity bought and the difficulty in getting it away, for the buyer was a transporter and, as a rule, furnished the barrels or boats in which he carried off his oil. It was not long before the speculative character of the oil trade, due to the great fluctuations in quantity, added a crowd of brokers to the regular buyers who tramped up and down the creek. When the railroads came in, the trains became the headquarters for both buyers and sellers. This was the more easily managed, as the trains on the creek stopped at almost every oil farm. These trains became, in fact, a sort of traveling oil exchange, and on them a large percentage of all the bargaining of the business was done.
And it was difficult, too, because a lot of the brokerages and so forth were, some of them were obviously, as I just said, operating in the actual area itself in Pennsylvania, but there were also oil exchanges pretty far away in places like New York City. They didn't get an exchange itself in Titusville until 1871. There's some interesting stuff that we'll talk about involving pipeline certificates that also became a key method of trading in oil and so forth. We'll get back to that in just a moment. But it was sort of, I thought this was an interesting view into like how underdeveloped this area was and how difficult it could be to maintain these prices and why they would get into these situations. That brings us to the question of storage and transportation. As they just alluded to, if you had oil pumping and you didn't have a way of selling it, then it was going to just go onto the ground if you didn't have a way of storing it. So first there were wooden tanks, then there were iron tanks. It says there were not barrels enough to be bought in all of America, although turpentine barrels, molasses barrels, whiskey barrels, every sort of barrel and cask were added to the new ones made especially for oil. Reservoirs were excavated in the earth and faced with logs and cement, and box-like structures of planks or logs were tried at first but were not satisfactory. It also says that one school teacher returned home to the region from the West and began a business producing wooden storage barrels for 10 years until he left the business when iron barrels became popular. Wooden tanks typically had a capacity of somewhere between 200 or 1,200 barrels. Iron tanks, by comparison, could hold 20,000 to 30,000 barrels of oil. Transportation, obviously, another huge issue. You had to get that oil out of there as fast as possible, and that was no easy feat. This was either done by teamsters, river floats, railroads, or pipelines. Quote, there was but one way to get the oil to the bank of Oil Creek or to the railroads, initially, before pipelines, and that was by putting it into barrels and hauling it. Teamsters equipped for this service seemed to fall from the sky. The farms for hundreds of miles gave up their boys and horses and the wagons to supply the need. It paid. There were times when $3 and even $4 a barrel were paid for hauling 5 or 10 miles. They mention here that these were really terrible roads. They often required the Teamster crews to improvise and divert through farmers' lands, which didn't make the farmers very happy. Many of the Teamsters made so much money from moving just even these small, short hauls of oil to larger connections that they became oil tycoons themselves. When pipelines were invented, a lot of them left the business to become, you know, producer owners themselves or whatever. Men who could transport the oil downriver to Pittsburgh could also sometimes make $70,000 per trip, which, again, think about how much. I mean, that's a decent chunk of money today, let alone in the 1870s or 1860s. By 1863, rail access, as Rachel was just talking about, had been put south from the Erie area to Titusville itself. This allowed the shipping of oil from the Pennsylvania oil regions out to the Atlantic coast city as well as to various refinery cities. Another key thing was the invention of oil pipelines. It took them a while to figure out how to do that efficiently and effectively. But Van Sickle's pipeline, he was a guy who was working on the development of this, partly because he didn't like the Teamsters, could carry 80 barrels per hour of oil. The Teamsters immediately began sabotage campaigns. You can read all about that in the chapter, the first chapter as well, where they would blow them up or break them or set them on fire or whatever. One of the pipeline and transportation companies, the Empire Transportation Company, became a sort of intermediary between all the different railroads in the area. Initially, they didn't cooperate very well between each other. They had non-standardized equipment, et cetera, and the Empire Transportation Company promised that they could, you know, basically get all this oil from the region and, you know, manage it themselves on the railroads. Like, they would supply the rail cars and everything and move them back and forth, you know, between the different railroads that had different gauges and everything, etc. The pipelines generally at first just moved oil over the local terrain to the rail connections, as opposed to today's, you know, super long pipelines that take it the full distance in many cases. The Empire Transportation Company, ETC, invented a system of certificates for balances of oil so that producers could put all their oil together in one pipeline and get paid out an appropriate amount for what arrived on the other end. These certificates became a convenient mechanism for trading oil on exchanges around the country, even quite far from the physical oil. Below the section that Rachel just read, it says, by this time, the pipelines had begun to issue certificates for the oil they received, and the trading was done to a degree in those. The method was simple and much more convenient to the old one. The producer ran his oil into a pipeline and for it received a certificate showing that the line held so much to his credit. This certificate was transferred when the sale was made and presented when the oil was wanted. And that would be, they would obviously do the trading right there in the Pennsylvania oil regions themselves, but they would also do it in farther away places like New York. And that's when you start getting this sort of virtualized market for oil rather than physically just like exclusively trading in like a barrel in front of you or whatever. The ETC also pioneered a kind of tax on the producers to cover potential damages to the pipelines from fires, etc. There were lots of natural things as well, not just the Teamsters. And when we're talking about the Teamsters, we're not talking about the Teamsters Union that didn't exist yet, but obviously an interesting sort of forerunner to some of their stuff. So that is sort of the key highlights from that first chapter of Ida Tarbell's book on the rise of the early U.S. oil industry in northwestern Pennsylvania. This is before we get into the discussions of refineries and so forth, and the rise of Standard Oil, which is covered in the later chapters. But Rachel, I think you would agree this is a lot of familiar stuff in this particular chapter to what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, it's, I guess the oil futures market has always kind of been a bit of a mystery. And I think starting with the very origins of it kind of helps illuminate that a little bit.
Yeah. And the fact that, you know, even in this period, they could have total freakouts if they heard that there was oil being discovered in a different country. So even that effect of like, oh, there was a big news item today that really affected the price of crude oil, like that dates all the way back to the 1860s and 1870s even. And in addition to obviously this longstanding issue of storage capacity and transportation and so forth, which also had profound effects. I mean, right, we're talking about a period period where sometimes they would be willing to pay a Teamster crew to take oil a few miles at the price of several dollars per barrel of oil. And this is in this time period, not even, you know, today. And then you'd have other times when the price would drop all the way to 10 cents a barrel, which gets pretty close to that zero mark that we just crossed over in the present day.
Right. And you kind of start seeing an inkling of what's to come, because people are starting to own the different stages. So people who own a well start to own the pipelines, start to own the refineries. So you kind of see what the future of the oil industry is to become.
Yeah, absolutely. And when we return to this in our next part on this, we will talk more about that aspect specifically surrounding Standard Oil and some of the other big capital investments that were made into this region. Capital investment in the region in 1865 was $100 million, rose to $200 million by 1872. The total capital investment from 1859 to 69 might have been as high as $350 million, although it's hard to know for sure given the proliferation of various sort of fake and speculative companies that arrived. But there was a huge, like the oil industry itself, there's a lot of stuff that's obviously still relevant today, but the early U.S. oil industry has a profound effect on a bunch of other industrial things and transportation companies and so forth in that time period. And for that reason, it is worth understanding. And that's why we're going to return to this. But this very early sort of wildcat phase of drilling and everything and the storage crises reminded us a lot of what was going on in the current oil markets today. All right, Rachel, thank you so much for joining me this week on the show to talk about this.
Thanks, Bill.